once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And the telephone number in here is 254-773-1400 if you would like to join us. I can't believe that we have said nothing sufficiently controversial that somebody wouldn't call up and tell us we were stupid.
Oh, I think they're just listening, letting us have as much rope as we want and maybe dig the hole deeper.
Okay.
Now that we were rough on trade, happy on regulation, I've got one other thing.
Happy on deregulation.
On deregulation, yes. The proposed U.S. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin.
Oh, you learned how to pronounce his name.
Mnuchin. When he was having his testimony before the Senate, he said something that I thought was fantastic.
A lot of the president's nominees have said things I think are fantastic. But go ahead. What was your favorite there?
He's talking about a newer, better 21st century version of Glass-Steagall. And to most people out there, people out there, Glass-Steagall, is that, what is that? Some kind of a sky rise? Is glass? And no, Glass-Steagall was the separation of commercial banks and investment banks. Commercial banks are the ones that you go to for the mortgage, the ones you go to put your deposits at the bank. The investment banks are the big Wall Street banks that do all the big investments.
Like Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan and...
One of the biggest contributors to the Great Recession that we've crawled back out of was the abolishment of one of the Glass-Steagall Acts that allowed investment banks and commercial banks to commingle their assets, to own each other, if you will. And we've got, you know, for instance, J.P. Morgan Chase is an example. That's J.P. Morgan and Chase. Chase is the commercial bank. They do credit cards. They do... mortgages, they do all that good stuff. They take deposits. And then JP Morgan, which is the investment bank side. So JP Morgan Chase exists, and a lot of other investment banks exist with commercial banks that didn't exist before. The way that the mortgage-backed securities were packaged into the investment products that caused some of the downfall that led to the dominoes falling in the Great Recession was directly because the investment bank was able to take the commercial bank's assets and sell them in a different way, to take risks with them that they normally would not have taken. So Glass-Steagall, I think, is a really good limitation on the way commercial banks can use our deposits. And some of the Glass-Steagall Acts are still in place, and people thought even back at the heyday of this could never happen again before the Great Recession, they still said these are important things to keep in place. Well, what Secretary-to-be Steve Mnuchin, was he confirmed, by the way? I don't think he was confirmed yet.
He was testifying, I think, before a committee. I don't think he's been confirmed.
Right. So what he's talking about is putting safeguards back in place there. He's talking about not regulating banks based on their size, but based on their actions, which I think is a much better way of approaching this than the Dodd-Frank monster that was created, which just basically said once you get to a certain size, you have massive amounts of regulatory requirements. And as we said at the end of last hour, when there's an impediment to going forward, people find other ways. So there's lots and lots of companies out there that 10 years ago would be public companies. They would have gone through their IPOs and they would be available to purchase by anybody. And they are still private, closely held, because they don't want to have to go through the regulatory rigmarole of simply becoming a public entity. So anyway, we've hit two positives and a negative. The immigration side of things, I believe, is a negative as far as the nuances aren't being followed. I think a lot of these decisions are good decisions, but they require a great deal of thought and a great deal of conversation before they go into order. and they've been sent into order already. So anyway, that was my, we've now covered four events very lightly, two of them more heavily, dealing with executive orders this last week. You've got some things that you said you wanted to talk about.
Well, he hadn't been confirmed by the entire Senate, but he did pass out of the committee with a positive. And I'm sorry that there's a little noise coming out here.
Yes, your computer's talking to you.
I don't like it when my computer talks to me without me giving it permission to do so.
Your phone was talking to you last hour. Now your computer's talking to you this hour. It's a voice activated and video on demand stuff is scary.
Yeah. Let's talk about the GDP for just a GDP report that came out for just a moment.
Cool.
There's a couple of things that went with that. One, the Consumer Confidence Index, and there's actually several of them, is sitting very nearly at a record high at this point. Consumers are indicating extreme confidence that things will be better over the next year, and that specifically it's related to the election of President Trump and the fact that the general sense in the consumer side of the population is that jobs will be available, things will be affordable, and everybody is going to do very well over the next year. Now, that generally indicates that people are about to spend some more money. And sure enough, household outlays in the fourth quarter, a lot of that was before the election, obviously. It's about split November, December. Two-thirds of it was after the election. So what we saw was an increase of 2.5% in consumer household spending in the fourth quarter. Now, that's a huge positive because it's not done very well over the past. The other thing that has not done well in past GDP reports is the investment by business in their own businesses. As a matter of fact, it was pretty much stagnant. It was less than 1% growth through most of the last couple of years. And in the fourth quarter, it went up at a 2.4% annual rate in that quarter. It was 1.4% in the third quarter. It was starting to pick up already. Those are two very, very powerful trends that kicked everything forward. The biggest drain in the calculations of the gross domestic product of the United States in this report was they subtracted 1.7% from GDP growth because we imported a lot more than we exported. And I am of the opinion, Jake's of the opinion, and we mentioned it at some length in the newsletter this week, that's silly. And the reason I say that's silly is for 40 years, the United States has been running this huge deficit in its what's called current account, which boils down to the fact that we theoretically buy a lot more than we sell. And if the United States were a business, we would have been bankrupt 20 years ago.
More than 20, maybe even 40 years ago.
Well, it just started. It started 40 years ago. About 40 years ago, before that, we actually had a trade surplus. Now, that doesn't make any sense. I mean, you can't, like this last year, we had a trade deficit of $500 million. And if you add that up over a 40-year period,
that's a lot of money.
It really is a tremendous amount of money. And so what? Is it $500 million or $500 trillion? $500 billion? Yeah, $500 billion.
$500 trillion, yeah.
It's $500 trillion.
The $500 million is a little low.
And the fact is, it just ain't so. If you took that trade deficit out of the calculation, the United States economy would have grown at 3.6% in the fourth quarter and more in earlier periods. And since 1.9 is, or 2.1 was the annual, 1.9 was the total annual growth, we would have a 3.6% growth, which, by the way, not coincidentally, very much matches the growth we were seeing when our trade balance was about zero. We were importing and exporting about the same amount.
Well, this is a fascinating area. This is one that you and I both agree that it'd be really, really nice if there was a new way of calculating the GDP. This is something we've talked about for decades on this program, that the way of calculating the GDP is from the 1920s. The concept of removing your export-import difference without accounting for who made the profit, without accounting for was there an actual financial transaction. But the problem that we have in getting that changed to something that's more realistic is the same problem with getting the QWERTY keyboard changed on your computer.
Well, you know, this is...
The QWERTY keyboard was designed to be a slow typing tool so that your typewriter didn't get tangled up while you were typing. Well, you and know, we're still stuck with it.
There's an interesting point. China does not count imports and exports when they figure their GDP, and we just report it.
Right.
And we figure up imports and exports when we count our GDP and reduce our GDP and say, oh, how terrible. The reality is, and this is, and if you'd like to get our newsletter, we can send you a copy of it, preferably digitally, but we can mail it too. Going to some length in there about the fact that the dollar is so phenomenally different than the Chinese currency, which is either the yuan or renminbi, and I never have been able to figure out which one we should call it or how often.
Let's just call it the yuan because it's easier.
Okay, that makes sense. Anyway, the yuan is only used in China to buy and sell things. Now, there is some exchange outside of the country, but it's actually very limited.
Right.
And they restrict it as much as they possibly can.
It's more a ceremonial exchange for being part of the World Bank rather than – or the IMF rather than actual use of it as a currency.
If you're really, really wealthy, you can actually export a total of $50,000 equivalent worth of yuan each year. Which isn't much for a really wealthy person.
No.
So the point is that the Chinese use the U.S. dollar when they buy things overseas to import into China. They don't use their currency, which means that our currency is not something we buy and sell things with, although it is that too. It is also a product that is manufactured by the banking system in the United States. We export it to places like China, who buys it from us. And the price is rising, which means there's a lot more people, has been rising all year, past couple of years, which means that there's a lot more people who want to buy that product than sell that product. Now, what that means is, if we were to turn around and say, we're trading one thing for another, it isn't, in other words, if we send dollars overseas, well, let's use Mexico as an example. We send dollars to Mexico and get car parts back. That is not a deficit. That is a free exchange of goods of equal value. And the Mexicans then have the dollars, which are much more stable than their currency, and they use those dollars to buy things from someplace else. That means the dollar is, in fact, a financial instrument, and if it were manufactured by Goldman Sachs instead of by the Federal Reserve, and it was exported by Goldman Sachs, and we sold them to Mexico, and we sold them to China, which is what we're doing when we buy something. We're selling dollars, and they're giving us stuff in return for dollars. It's kind of like a barter transaction. That would count as an export. And so we would never have a trade imbalance of any kind. And in fact, I don't think we have a trade imbalance of any kind.
I agree. And this is something to confuse a confusing issue earlier or simplify it. This is a flat statement. It doesn't have anything to do with ethics or morality. It's a flat statement. If the regulatory tax and government spending reforms take place that President Trump has said he wants, our economy is going to grow at a very fast rate. There are some difficulties with that. And this is, do you agree with what I've just said?
Yes, it's a big word at the beginning of your sentence, though.
Right.
A two-letter word that's huge, if.
If. If those take place, if we get regulatory reform that makes it easier to do business and keeps it safe for people doing business and people doing business with people doing business, that will be great. If we can lower taxes, that's going to put a lot more money into the hands of the American citizen who's much better able to spend it than a lot of other governmental positions. Here's the difficulty with that. The big if, there are fiscal conservatives in the House and the Senate that will not cut taxes unless spending is cut. And we've got spending reforms as part of the extra spending as part of Trump's promises. So when the president says he wants to cut taxes and raise spending, there's an immediate fight. If he could do it, it would be a tremendous boon to the economy for a period of time, probably for a decade or more.
It'd be like a business borrowing a lot of money.
Right.
To create extra manufacturing capacity.
Right. It's really good for the business short term. And if you can make the economy grow fast enough, it might be good long term for some other areas. The difficulty is that Social Security is still out there. Medicare is still out there. And those are obligations that we have to meet. And if we cut our revenue, we've got to borrow more for that. So the borrowing will come back to roost. That's the big issue, is that, yes, it will cause tremendous growth if all those things come together.
One of the things I'm looking for, and if there in fact is anybody listening.
I'm not listening.
Keep your eyes on this. This is a fascinating thing. There is almost no way I can't imagine with my stretching my brain to the maximum how we can enact the spending that President Trump has promised to give to stimulate the economy, and there's a lot of spending involved, without borrowing a bunch of money.
Yeah.
And I mean, we got $500 billion deficit, and the Congressional Budget Office says if we don't change anything, it will be a lower deficit next year, and then it will go up.
No matter what happens, things are going to change this year.
But if we lower taxes and increase spending, even if the argument is made that by lowering taxes and increased spending somewhere down the road, we will get more revenue into the government. Now, whether or not we hope that'll happen. But whether or not it happens is not the question. The question is, in the first year, when you cut revenue and you increase spending, if you're in a business, you have to go to the bank and borrow money to do that. If you're in the United States government, you have to authorize the debt ceiling to go through the stratosphere, repeal. Well, I don't know. They may have a loophole they can get around the Balanced Budget Act. But here's the question. Will the fiscal conservatives in the House, including John Carter, accept a massive increase in the deficit simply because there's a different president in the White House? If so, that sounds just a little bit hypocritical to me.
Yeah. So that's really what's going on here. And this is something that a lot of people on the Democrat side don't understand very well, because they've not been around a lot of Republicans, is that we, in essence, have three parties going right now. We've got a Trump populist party, and you'll appreciate this. He, in his executive order this week to remove the United States from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, there was an immediate press conference held by Bernie Sanders, who stepped in and thanked Donald Trump from the bottom of his heart for removing us from this horrible thing, the TPP. Well, Bernie Sanders is about as liberal as you can get.
Well, he's technically a socialist.
He is, literally. He admits it to anyone. He's a Democrat. He's a democratic socialist. He's called himself that. When the president, who is a Republican, is a socialist in some of his areas, then we're talking about a different party system than we're used to seeing. Used to be socialist was a really bad word in the Republican party.
And so was big government.
But now those words are being kind of used freely. And I realize that that's a hard thing to say, but There are certain areas where Trump is absolutely not a socialist, but he doesn't fit a normal mold. He doesn't fall into the party platform for the Republicans or the Democrats. And that's something the Democrats don't understand. They put all Republicans in the same group, and they say they all believe these things. And the Republicans tend to do the same thing about the Democrats. But Bernie Sanders is outside the normal Democrat. So we really have a three-party system.
We have, yeah.
That is
our four.
Or a four-party system, which causes the complexity in Washington to get much, much more. Yeah.
And
because the right. deal-making is going to have to go across all kinds of different directions, because you've got the fiscal conservatives. And there's the largest proponents of the fiscal conservatives, the ones that are the Freedom Caucus, the ones that, you know, lay down the law, we will not do this, we will shut down the government rather than going into debt, are also the ones that are the most supportive of Donald Trump right now. So there
we're going to see a breakout here.
At some point, there are going to be reorganizations on the chessboard here. The pieces are going to move around, and the support that Paul Ryan has is going to change. The support that Donald Trump has is going to change, and the support that Nancy Pelosi has is going to change. And how that settles out is fascinating to watch, and I'm glad I'm not in public office now.
There's some challenges facing Congress that are just amazing at this point. The Republicans have been, even though they had control of the House, they kept being blocked by the Senate and by the President. And now the Republicans have got control of both houses and the presidency, and there's a very high expectations on them. And I suspect what we're going to see is some big divisions show up. And it's just going to be absolutely fascinating to watch how this plays out.
Right. If the Republicans are not careful, they'll get exactly what the Democrats got when Barack Obama was elected the first time to a Democrat House and a Democrat Senate, and they could do whatever they wanted. But the bar gets set really high. All your promises have to be met, or the popularity drops, because there's nothing keeping you from doing those things. Well, the Republicans are in that boat now. Yeah, it was a huge win for the Republicans to have both the House, the Senate, and then the executive branch as well, because that means that there is nothing preventing them from doing their agenda except them. And that's where popularity drops, when the only people getting in your way are you, then people say you're not a very good leader. And that's something to be aware of. Don't get, if you're a strong Republican, don't get giddy over this. Pride goes before the fall. Look at what happened to the Democrats, and hopefully if the Republicans are listening, they're going to figure out that they have to work across the aisle, or in 8 years, the decisions that they do today without any Democrat support are going to be the things in the Democrat crosshair, just like Obamacare is in the Republican crosshair. It didn't have any Republican support. And you got to compromise. We are one nation. We're not half a nation in power at any given time. So that compromise has to be there. And we said the same thing to the Democrats. They didn't listen. So hopefully the Republicans are going to listen.
It will be interesting.
It will be. And we've got some commercials to play. You up for that now?
I am.
All right. Then I will get the commercials go. If you'd like to...
Telephone number in here. And we have not had a... I don't know whether we're just that boring.
Yes.
254-773-1400. And we'd like to hear what you think about all this. It certainly stirs up our semi-somnolent brains if we get some calls in here. So if today is Saturday, January 28th, where you are, give us a call at 254-773-1400 and tell us what you think. And this is the Personal Wealth Coach.
We'll be back.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And what do we want to talk about next?
I don't know. What should we talk about next?
Let's see. We talked about the GDP, and we said that was really doing well. We talked about the fact that was it Gene Epstein? You know, Ben Levinson in Trader, in Barron's, the Trader column, is an interesting analysis of what happens if manufacturing, if all of the 20% tax, the corporate tax on imported goods and the tax deductibility of exported goods, if all that comes to pass and everything works out really, really well, companies like Illinois Tool Works, who has a big presence in this area, plan to shift to automation. Now, that's a local impact. When Illinois Tool Works is quoted as saying that they, if this all comes to pass, what they will do is start replacing American workers with robots and machines, that should get everybody's attention. In other words, there will be changes, and the changes that we've been forecasting, that if indeed we move manufacturing back to the United States, it won't be people we'll be hiring, it'll be robots that we'll be hiring. And sure enough, there's an article in Barron's today that says that that's exactly what some of the biggest manufacturing companies in the United States are going to do.
Well, I mean, it's a very simple equation. If the reason why they shipped their jobs overseas was price, and the prices are going to go up unless they bring the manufacturing back home, then they bring the manufacturing back home at the cheapest way they can do it and still maintain the quality, which is robotics. I mean, it's just a very simple premise. We're not going to be saving jobs doing this. And this is something we've talked about this in the past, and this may be a good segue to talk about it again, that the history of job exports, you know, at the beginning of the United States, the North had all of the manufacturing jobs. They had all the manufacturing jobs because industry was built around running water. In order to have things that you could manufacture with machinery, you needed a mill house. You needed a running water to turn a wheel. And the majority of the good high-pressure running water was in the Northeast. So the South was big in agriculture. They brought up the cotton. And that cotton got exported up to the North. And it was really considered exports at the time, because back then the states' rights were much closer to the way we look at the European Union, Germany versus Italy, much more than we think of it today as a one nation. So that cotton was sent up to the Northeast, and the Northeast made it into textiles and sent it overseas. Well, then steam engines came around in the mid-1800s. Mid to late 1800s, steam engines start really doing well, and that meant that all you needed was water, not pressurized water. And if you look at the newspaper headlines of the Northeast, starting in about the early 1870s, you see a lot of jobs leaving, going south, going to places where the labor was cheaper and they could set up a manufacturing facility using newest technology. Those jobs never came back. Technology keeps moving forward, and as technology moves forward, new jobs get made. Old jobs disappear. If we are fighting for jobs like what we had in the 1970s at the peak of the jobs in America in manufacturing, that's never coming back, not unless we go backwards as far as our economy goes by so much that nobody would feel good about having those jobs.
And a more recent event was the VCR.
That's a great one.
Some of us old folks can remember VCRs.
For those of you that don't know what that is, it's kind of like an 8-track player for videos.
Right. It's a video cassette recorder, only very few of us did much recording on it. We mostly did playback.
Right.
Yeah. And they were the big thing, and they were invented in the United States. And at some point, there was a lot of bewailing and moaning that when somebody realized that at some point that none of them were being manufactured in the United States anymore, they're being manufactured in India and China and Japan. Well, it was only a few years later that they basically went away.
because technology moved right. on.
And that's the way it is when jobs leave and go someplace else. They don't come back. If the manufacturing comes back, it comes back through automation. It doesn't come back through the job being replaced at the high wages that we had before any more than the relatively good, secure employment on farms could ever be duplicated.
Yeah, there was a really good statement that Ford used to make, and this was in the 1930s. They were talking about the strength of the new technology that Ford was using. 115 people touched a car before it was completed. 115 people just in the plant.
Mm-hmm. And that's because he invented – well, he didn't invent it, but he began making cars using an assembly line.
Right. That assembly line meant that 115 people touched that car. Well, an assembly line today at Ford, you're talking about 15 people.
Right. I think it is 15.
And an assembly line at Tesla, you're talking about one or two. Mm-hmm. People.
And right at the end, probably.
Right. And that's just checking quality and going over it. So what we're talking about is a inexorable shift away from the way we've manufactured in the past. And I mentioned last week and several other times that John Henry is another example of a time period when technology replaced labor. That people lost their jobs. John Henry was a steel-driving man, and he could, you know, he did the whole fight against the machine that was putting the massive spikes down in to put the railroad tracks in place. Well, once the railroad tracks are built, you just got repair on it. So all these people that were employed there, they lost their jobs. Was it exported? Well, it went away. Well, what did they do? Well, they found something. And that's been the consistent yeah. pattern throughout history is we've got to find new and better things to employ ourselves. The thing that's different now is the time frame, the amount of time between, you know, when people think I'm going to have a job for 40 years in manufacturing, you can't really say that anymore.
Well, you know, we say it's the time frame. We get a call?
Yeah, we have a call.
Oh, well, let's go to the call, 773-1400.
Caller, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Anyway, you were talking about robotics taking over human jobs. Don't humans have to originally build the robots in
yep.
the first place?
Well, not always.
Originally. Originally, yes.
Yeah, there's a robot someplace that's built by human beings, but that robot can then build other robots to build robots. So that in many cases, for instance, the robots that are currently have replaced the workers at General Motors were mostly built by robots.
Well, what about maintenance? Now, I know that
yeah.
we have robots
right.
to maintain the other robots.
Right. At this point, humans are still the majority of the maintenance
right.
for robots, but that's going to change too.
But there's fewer humans maintaining the robotic assembly lines than there were humans maintaining the mechanical assembly lines because they just don't break down as often.
Yeah.
Well, what about the ones that have to maintain the robots?
Oh, there'll be a few. There's a couple of things to note about these people. First off, they're very highly trained. And secondly, there's a relatively small number of them. And the people who were previously working on the assembly lines were not highly trained. I mean, it's on the job. And I use this as an example, and I think it's a good example, because I read once about an actual person who did this. His job was the left front fender at a General Motors assembly plant. He bolted on the left front fender of who knows how many hundreds of thousands of cars.
I've got a friend, it's a direct example, a friend of mine who got out of the military and started working at a hospital bed factory. And his job was putting on 5 bolts. It was the same 5 bolts repeatedly, 5 bolts for one of the
yeah.
the rails that come up on the side. That was his job,
mm-hmm.
5 bolts, and he did it hundreds of times a day.
I think that's one of the reasons unions came about, is because these boring, monotonous jobs were so low paying and sort of killed the spirit of the worker. And they began to collectively bargain so they could get better pay, better hours, and that really started the whole union thing.
Well, that's part of it. Mostly it was the fact that the companies were severely abusing the workers and treating them very, very poorly. And it still goes on in places in the United States.
There are laws against that kind of treatment today, though.
Well, sort of.
I mean, if the workers don't complain, there's not much anybody's going to do about it.
You know, we still have, in Texas particularly, we still have construction workers who are contract workers, and they show up and they do their work, and if they get hurt or if they get sick or if, you know, whatever, they're gone. And in other words, they're used up and thrown away, and we see a lot of them in the emergency room with no health insurance, with diabetes and a lot of other things. And so we still have some of that going on, but you're right. That's where the unions came from. And the issue is that robots are not unionized, and I'll almost certainly assure you that the people who work on the robots won't be union members, because they'll be highly educated technicians, and they'll be in high demand. They'll be very intelligent people.
Until the robots are doing the maintenance on the robot.
Right. But there may be fewer of them. But the point is, if you educate up, if you're very intelligent, you educate up and you figure out how to maintain robots today, you got a job, because there's a high demand for them. There's the United States right now, last I heard, and I may have my numbers wrong here, but there's something like 500,000 unfilled jobs in the United States.
Yeah.
500,000 unfilled jobs that employers are desperate to have somebody fill, and the major corporations are going to Congress and are begging the president, please allow us to have people come in from outside the United States to fill these jobs, because we simply can't find any Americans to do them.
Your numbers are wrong.
What were they?
6 million.
6 million. Well, it's pretty close.
5.9 million unfilled job openings.
I'm going to let you guys go and listen.
6 million. Did I say 5 million earlier?
Thanks for the call. We really appreciate it.
So I said 5 million earlier, and it's 6 million. Okay.
You said 500,000.
Oh, okay. So there's 6 million. There's 6 million job openings in the United States that American employers, generally very good paying jobs,
right,
that American employers simply can't find anybody to fill. You know, frankly, the sensible thing to do, I think, under those circumstances, is to say, all right, where have we got unemployed people that could fill those jobs if they were properly educated? Remember I told you earlier, something the equivalent of the GI Bill? Because we had a bunch of people go off to World War II, broke communities, changed communities so that they learned to function without these people. They come back from World War II with new technology that had been developed during World War II, and the economy needed better educated people with higher technical skills. And so Congress passed the GI Bill and said, okay, here we go. You guys that used to be down on the farm and went out to be infantrymen, we will pay for your educations so that you can go back into the industrial workplace and make a living, because the farm's gone. There's a tractor there that has replaced you, or something has replaced you while you were gone off fighting the war. It's going to take something as visionary as that to turn this issue around. The difficulty is, and this is going to be a hard one, a lot of those unemployed people are in their 50s and 60s. And they would probably love to retire, but aren't going to be able to retire unless they're just on Social Security.
Right.
And how much time do we have, and how much capability do we have, and how much willingness do they have to be educated?
To retrain themselves to do something else. Right. That's not the thing you want to do right at the last part of your career, is train yourself to do something else. Now, the good thing about that is that there are certain individuals in that group that retrain themselves in a new area and love it so much that they suddenly don't want to stop working anymore. They love going to work.
Do you mean like there's some guys who are like 67 years old and still show up for work? And
yeah, and kind of like the
old... You just need to buy them a new computer?
Yeah, the old bald man across from me, actually.
Yeah.
So the concept here of revitalizing yourself can be at any age. It's just harder to do later.
Well,
and that's something that's, you know,
did we already do commercials?
We did. Okay. The commercials are all done. And that's one of the things that is, it's really hard for an economist to measure when people are retraining. There's so much of the data doesn't come together. It's a piece over here and a piece over here, and we have to try to make them fit together. But one side doesn't have age associated with it. We just know they're not working. And another side has the age and retraining associated with it. So we're trying to put together a picture of what's really going on. And we're getting pretty good at putting the picture together, but it's not always completely accurate. And it's kind of like, you know, the first way in the early 1800s that they used to check blood pressure. They realized that blood pressure was a really important thing, that you needed to have good blood pressure.
Cut you and see how high you spurted?
They used a glass vial, okay, that was open on one end. It was like a needle on the other, and they would shove it up inside your vein, and they would look to see how high up the vial the blood would go, and that was your blood pressure. And the problem with it was when they removed the vial, you bled a lot, and that lowered your blood pressure. And
well, that's a good way to get low blood, get your high blood pressure.
Right. So when we're measuring the economy, we've got better tools than we used to, but I still think we're in the glass vial days of measuring the economy, and there are better tools out there that we can utilize, better technology, to look and see what's really going on. And hopefully we'll be doing that more in the future.
I want to bring up something that's ironic.
Let's
save
that.
This for the end. And it's in the newsletter. I was doing some research into the wall, trying to figure out the economic implications of the wall and how it was going to
be. The wall,
be.
Let's capitalize that for,
I
the,
did,
for
yeah,
the radio.
The
it's
wall,
all capitalized.
The,
yes.
The border wall. And looking at estimates of what it would cost, and not from the government, because, you know.
Paul Ryan says $12 billion. Donald Trump now is saying $8 billion, but at differing times during his campaign, he said $6 billion and $14 billion. So we don't know what that is from the government perspective. From a private perspective, you had a good estimate.
There are some analysts who've looked at it and said, to, in addition to the wall that's already there, if we build the wall and buy the property and all the other stuff that it's done, we've got a pretty good measure of what it takes, and it'd be about $25 billion. And that's just the starting fee, by the way. It takes $25 billion to get the wall up and functional, but then you got to hire thousands of people.
Well, let's hire robots for that.
We got to hire thousands of people to patrol the wall, because otherwise people just put up ladders and go over the wall and drop down on the other side. And a lot of that area is, you know, pretty wide open. We've got sensors there, but the problem is the people are gone before the Border Patrol shows
2
up.
2 hours to get there.
So you're talking about hiring not just the 5,000 that has been mentioned so far, but more like 15,000 minimum. 15,000, that'd be the minimum number of new hires. So it would go up to 20,000 when you include so we have to hire 20,000 people to patrol. So $25 billion is probably the low end. But here's the interesting thing. Bernstein and Company did some engineering analysis on it. And they concluded that it would require 7 million cubic meters of concrete made with 2.4 million tons of cement. Okay, that makes perfectly good sense.
That's a lot of cement.
It is. Nothing like what it will take if we do the highway infrastructure across the United States.
Right.
But it's a pretty good-sized chunk of cement.
Yeah, the thing is we're planning on doing highway infrastructure as well.
Right. Now, here's the interesting point. The largest cement manufacturer in the United States is Cemex, or in North America is Cemex, which is a Mexican company. Now, admittedly, they have like 500 plants in the United States and employ around 10,000 people in the United States, but they're still a Mexican company, and profits will go to Mexico if they make profits, and they are the only company with enough slack, enough reserve left in their manufacturing capacity and the physical locations, which needs to be fairly near the wall. You can't mix concrete in Minnesota and drive it in that rotating concrete thing all the way to the border and use it. It just doesn't work.
Well, I don't know why not.
They have a chain and they dominate the Southwest, where they take it all the way from rock to laid concrete, to the concrete comes out of the back of the truck. Now, the fascinating thing is, if we spent $25 billion on that wall, a big chunk of it would go to CEMEX, a Mexican company. And the irony there is right off the screen. Now, the president could say, oh, no, it's a Mexican-owned company.
We're not going to use them.
We'll use an American company.
Well, that means that all the highway infrastructure would have to use CEMEX.
Right.
Because the highway infrastructure, the capacity, we're already up close to the 80 percentile range.
We're right at 80% on cement manufacturing in the United States.
Which means there's not a lot of leeway for extra concrete. Mm-hmm. Now, they can increase their plant size. They can do a lot of things.
That takes a lot of time.
But that takes time. It takes infrastructure costs. It has got a lot of things that come into play here.
And then you hit another wall.
Which wall?
You hit a wall on when you decide to build a bunch more plants, there's nobody to work there. Now, what we would do under the current environment,
mm-hmm.
if we were trying to do something that took a lot of concrete, we would just import a lot of it from Mexico.
Yeah.
But importing concrete, since the president has said he wants the infrastructure to all be built with American-made stuff, and he wants the wall to be built with American-made stuff. And the American company, the only company that has the capacity of doing that is a Mexican company operating partially in the United States.
Right.
I think the humor there.
It's very ironic.
And it will wreck the GDP.
The rhetoric meeting reality is one of those things that every president has to face. Every president comes up with these ideas, and they're beautiful ideas, until you look at the factual reality of actually trying to do the thing as stated.
I thought
it's harder than it looks.
When I first realized this, somebody has looked at this in advance. There's got to be something going on. 2 weeks ago, the price of CEMEX was $8 per share on the New York Stock Exchange, CX. It's up 18% in the last 2 weeks. So somebody else has figured this out.
This
too.
Is not a recommendation to buy
no.
it. In fact, it would be a recommendation to stay away from it, because the whole concept of what they're doing, all it takes is one tweet.
And that stock price
gone.
Would collapse. But the point is, there's nobody else to do it. And that's just one of those ironies that when you make policy, it's probably a good idea to think about it first.
Right. And at some point, hopefully, we will have reality coming into the rhetoric, but it's not as popular when you talk reality. Unfortunately, it's harder to get elected when you're talking nuances than when you're talking sound bites. And our president is a great
campaigner,
mm-hmm. and he is really amazing at giving good sound bites. The difficulty, and this is advice to Republicans and advice to Democrats. Both of you, don't give up hope. Instead, start talking to each other. Find the common ground. And I've heard those words come out of Trump's mouth, and I've heard those words come out of Nancy Pelosi's mouth. And the word Trump to most Democrats causes their stomachs to turn. The word Pelosi to most Republicans causes their stomachs to turn. But if both of them are saying, how do we work together, then we may have some ability to be a great, great, even greater than we are, nation. And I don't so much agree with Make America Great Again as far as just making America greater than it's ever been. So that's my statement.
That rhymes.
Yeah. Rhetoric that rhymes. I should get elected.
So just to kind of summarize this, the Dow did cross 20,000. GDP came in at 1.9, which we think is not an accurate number. It's probably a higher number than that.
That's the first estimate on GDP.
It's the first estimate, and we don't like the way it's calculated.
Yeah.
The S&P 500 rose 1.5%. It's up 2.5% for the year and about 18% for 12 months. And it's going to look a lot better as we go into mid-February. The 12-month number is going to look really, really good. Really, really good. Really, 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 really,
really
good.
Really fantastic.
Yeah, really fantastically good. Because last year we were slipping at this point into a market correction. So when you measure 1 year out, it really, 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 really looks good. So we'll see how it works from there. And just in case you're interested in talking to us during the week or on the, when we're not on the air, we do manage investment portfolios and assist people in their financial affairs. And our telephone number off the air locally is 254-947-1111. That's 254-947-1111, the personal wealth coach.
You can reach that number toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. Not that toll-free means the same thing anymore. Most people use their cell phones, so toll-free is kind of irrelevant. If you would like to go to our webpage, it's thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can read our philosophy. Our newsletters are up there. Our podcasts, in case you haven't gotten enough insanity of two voices yammering on about economics, you can check out our podcasts. You can check out our ugly mugs and our beautiful staff. Until next week, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.
True. It's not just a word on your Fox News station. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM, Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.